Hello, I'm Susan Auerbach, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. Our guest today is Barry Daniel, who with Robert Ellis is a founding member of the Middle Way Society. You'll usually hear him on the other side of the conversation as host, but today he's graciously agreed to sit in the guest seat. Thank you, Barry, and welcome. It's a pleasure to have you as a guest today.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, great. Let's start at the beginning. Where were you born? Tell us a bit about your background.
Okay, well, I was born in the north of England in Manchester. I had some very loving parents. My dad was worked on the shop floor of a copper making company. He was a stock controller. My mum, she spent lots of time working in offices. She worked at the post office for a while. She was a person that, from an early age, was always involved in voluntary work and stuff. And I think that sort of caring attitude of hers had an impact on me. She was the sort of person that if someone was feeling vulnerable or whatever, she was often the person they would talk to. Yeah, so I feel very fortunate when I had very supportive parents that gave me boundaries but also allowed me to explore who I wanted to be, really.
Yeah, and explore you've done. I've seen all these things that you've done. It's so great. Starting with the Navy, you said, shifting with the Middle Way Society attitude, which you probably didn't have at age 17, possibly.
I was daft as a brush at that age, really. And also, I didn't really do very well at school. I didn't like school at all, really. I found it very restrictive, and I gave my mum a lot of worries, actually. I spent a lot of time just playing truant, and she'd actually walk to school with me, and then I'd go into the school buildings, and then she'd go off to work, and then I'd go out again. I just hated it. It was for a long time, it was the happiest day of my life, the day school ended. And then and then after that, I went to college for a while and did some what we call in the UK A-levels. But again, I didn't really work. I just was interested in getting drunk, really, and having a good time. But then I knew that I needed to do something with my life. And my horizons, I felt, were quite limited in Manchester. It was like going down to the pub, or, you know, it was just quite a run-down industrial city at the time. And and the Navy seemed to offer a way out, really. And so I spent 3 years in the Navy. But I actually got chucked out of the Navy, which was actually quite a feat. I mean, at the time, there was about 120,000 people in the Navy, and there was only about three or four people got chucked out a year. So you had to be pretty bad.
But quite an accomplishment.
Well, I mean, I didn't do anything really bad. It was just a lot of it was drink related stuff and minor offences of insubordination, and not that was lippy. I was just a bit mischievous, and I like the attention, and so I'd get into trouble doing that. But I did learn a few things with it. I mean, you live down in what's called a mess, you know, with sort of 40-odd, it was just men at the time, and I really learned how to sort of rub along with people, because, you know, if you had an argument with someone, you could go up on deck, but you had to go back down and live with that person again. So that was useful. And also the experience of actually being chucked out was, it made me feel that I was like a round peg in a square hole, but it made me, you know, experience myself as an individual maybe for the first time.
And maybe it spurred you to explore where you're explored in some way, perhaps.
Well, yeah, and also the other thing that the Navy did, it just really opened my eyes to the world, because I just thought after I'd left, I thought I'm off. And I travelled then. Well, I spent most of my adult life abroad, and I only came back to the UK a few years ago.
Mm-hmm. I'd love to hear more about your travels, the places you lived.
Yeah, the next place I went was about 2 or 3 months after the Navy left me. I went on a kibbutz, and maybe I was still sort of quite politically naive and unaware, but I really liked the idea of communal living, and I was drawn to that at that age. I probably was quite sort of pro-Israel at time, and didn't you know, I really see that, you know, Israel has a right to exist, but I do feel that they haven't been brilliant on the foreign policy front, etc.
And about what year was this when you went to the kibbutz?
This was in 1980.
Oh, wow. So this is, that's relatively recent.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I went twice, actually. I went in 1980, and I think I went the following year, 1981. And that was a really interesting experience. And also, it was the first time I met women on an equal footing for a first time. In my upbringing in Manchester, I went to an all-boys school, and also in the Navy, it was a very sort of male, macho culture. And so I met girls as friends for the first time on the kibbutz, which was really interesting. My partner, Kate, says that she's still knocking the Navy out of me, even after all these years.
That's funny.
And then what did I do? And then I shortly afterwards, I ended up in Germany, and I spent most of my 20s in Germany. First of all, I was living rough for a while. I don't know if you've ever read the book by George Orwell, Down and Out in London and Paris.
No, I haven't. I'll look at that.
That was a sort of inspiration for me, so I thought I'd like to try that. And I spent a few months, well, living rough, but also because, again, I was just very lazy, really. And then I saved up enough money to buy a guitar, and I then bussed for a couple of 2 or 3 years in Europe. Found another guy that we used to go around all of Europe, really, busking.
What kind of music did you do?
I played the guitar and the mouth organ. And
like folk music, or?
Well, yeah, but then if you played stuff that you liked on the street, well, what I liked anyway, you wouldn't get a crowd, so you tended to play sort of songs that were quite popular and the people could sort of maybe dance to, or at least get the crowd going.
That's great. What sort of, so you played for the audience?
Yeah, I mean, if to make a living, basically, because if you played the stuff I liked, then you wouldn't make any money.
The life of a musician at every level, I'm sure. And you did that, so you were in Germany for how long?
Altogether about 7 years. I eventually started, eventually married a German woman, very young. I was 22, and that didn't last very long, about 2 years. And then I started doing regular work in factories and building sites. Then I had another relationship with a woman for about 5 years. And during that time, my mum got ill in England. And then I went back to the UK and stayed with her until she died. My partner in Germany was very kind to allow me to stay with my mum. And then I stayed with my dad until he sort of got back on his feet after my mum died, and that was a valuable lesson from my dad, because although I always knew my dad loved me, we had a sort of quite a male relationship where we bonded through going to the football match, and we didn't really talk about emotional stuff really. But then when my mum died, he grieved really well, if that makes sense. He just let all this emotion really wash through him, and we became very tactile, and we held hands and cuddled a lot. And also it was the first time in my life that I'd really assumed responsibility, because I suddenly had to do everything. I had to organise the funeral, and my dad sort of lost it really, and so I had to look after my dad. But then after about 6 or 7 months, we had a real role reversal. He was about 70 at the time, and he started going out with another woman, and we had a real role reversal. It was me stuck in on Saturday night watching the television, and him going out dancing.
So I guess he was on his feet, okay, at that
Yeah,
point.
he was. Yeah, but what was really nice, he then married Joyce, which is this woman, and had spent a further 18 years with her. But he could talk about my mum in front of her with a tear in his eye, and it wasn't a problem at all because she'd had a loving relationship with her fella. They were really good mates. They were really good friends, and that was really nice. And and then we went back to a bit more. We stopped kissing and cuddling, but it drew us a lot closer, that experience.
Kind of opened your hearts for each other in a way, in the grief.
Yeah. And then at the end of the 80s, I spent about 6 or 7 months in India. That was quite a formative experience as well. I was still, I think, I was still struggling with getting over with the death of my mum. And I was fascinated in India by how they sort of dealt with death. And I spent a lot of time looking at the funeral ceremonies in Varanasi, where they would burn the bodies of loved ones and then scatter the ashes in the Ganges. And it was interesting to me how so much part of life death was to them in India. There wasn't the finality and the darkness and the avoidance that we have. You know, at least in the UK, we tend to euphemize death a lot, talking about passing away, and we don't even look at dead bodies here. At least in the States, you have that ritual where you often go and see a dead body, don't you?
If you're Christian, if you're Jewish, no.
Of course not. Yeah. Well, anyway, that was really interesting, and I went and worked at Mother Teresa's place in Calcutta for a couple of months.
Wow. What was that experience like?
It was really interesting. You were just, what the objective mainly there was most of the people that were there at the time were dying and very close to death. A lot of them were suffering from TB, but it was a way for them to die with arguably a bit more dignity rather than just on the street. And my job there was just to wash them and feed them and talk to them. And a lot of them had some English, even though they were very, very poor most of the time. Well, all of the time, I think. But it was interesting how the majority of them didn't seem to have any fear of death. They seemed to accept their fate with great equanimity. And that was very impressive. I think a lot of it is because they think, if I keep my head down in this life, I might get a better deal in the next one, and then they obviously get exploited for that, because you know there's a lot of inequality in India. But it was nevertheless very, very impressive, and I had a lot of exposure to death, because people would die every day, and then we'd have to wheelbarrow. You'd get these corpses, and you'd wheelbarrow them to this truck, and it was. Yeah, so that was
amazing experience. Yeah. That must have been life changing.
Well, it was. India had a huge effect on me. I also remember when I was there at the time, I was almost sort of glowing. I don't know about you, Susan, but when I'm either feeling anxious or I'm feeling very happy, my sort of emotional center seems to be in my chest. And I can remember this glowing feeling in my chest that went on for months. I felt really sort of, remember writing loads of letters every week. I was just really connected with my thoughts. And I read a book recently by Alison Gopnik, who I've also interviewed recently. And she talked about where babies have this thing called lantern consciousness, where everything is of interest because everything is new, basically. And adults, we tend to have what she calls more of a spotlight consciousness. So our habits become more formed with the more we do it, and so those neural pathways get stronger, but we cut out a lot of other stuff in all these other neural connections, so our brains get leaner and meaner, but we're more closed-minded than babies. And then
that's
I asked,
right. Beginner's mind, I believe, is what the Buddhists call it, right?
Exactly. She said that. Yeah, she said the same thing. And I we were just talking about well, how can adults replicate that in adult life? And we talked about meditation and exactly beginner's mind, but also she mentioned travel, and especially to exotic places outside your own experience. And mm-hmm. I think I had that in India, because it was just so, it was like going to another planet. Everything mm-hmm. was a complete, I wouldn't say attack on your senses, but it was just, yeah, that's the only way I can describe it, really. So that was, it was a wonderful experience. And it was the only time I've really, really had culture shock when I came back, because I went from a culture which really embraces chaos to, mm-hmm. and I went back to Germany to one that's terrified of it.
Right. And wow.
I remember turning up in Berlin Airport and at the bus stop, and it was saying the bus was leaving at such and such a time, and it left by the second. It left. and after, you know, I don't know if you've ever been to India, you know, you get on a bus, well, then, and it might be 3 hours, and you sometimes it could take you 36, and you just had to sort of go with the flow, you know.
Right. Right. Yeah. I've never been there, but I have friends who love, they either love it or they hate it, one of the two.
Yeah, very much so, yes. And I think that's,
it depends on how lantern they're willing to be.
Yeah. And so, then after India, I ended up in South America, first on a walking holiday in Peru, and through, I met someone on a walking trip who told me about this course you could do called a TEFL course. I think you call it TESOL in the United States.
So teaching English as a second language.
That's right, yeah. And I did this course in Venezuela, and I managed to do the course. Normally you need a degree, and I don't have a degree, but I managed to get in the back door by being in a, by, I worked for a company called the British Council. I managed to do that course there, and they just needed the money, so I managed to squeeze in, sort of thing.
That's great.
And then for many years I worked for this company, and I first started working in Ecuador, and then I went back to Venezuela, and I met my present partner, Katie, there. She was my boss, still is.
Getting the Navy out of you.
And then we ended up in, well, we worked in a few countries, but ended up in Spain and lived there for about 14 years. And the last 10 years they were there, we had a walking holiday business. We took people into the mountains of northern Spain, and we trained up to be guides, but we also organized the accommodation and stayed with them all week.
Wow.
Made their sandwiches in the morning. So we were like the hosts, but also the guides as well. That was great fun.
Wow. So you, and obviously you knew Spanish.
Yeah, from South America, basically, yeah. Mm-hmm. And the plan was to actually eventually buy a place of our own there, like buy an old ruing or something. Mm-hmm. Like we did these courses in plastering and tiling and bricklaying, and we were going to buy an old ruin, but in 2008, sterling crashed against the euro. Mm-hmm. Our company was a British company, and although we had lots of American visitors as well, but then that crash made the business unsustainable, really. And so then we came back to the UK and worked in further education for a short while, and then finally we bought this guest house, and I have a guest house now with Katie in the Lake District of in Northern England, and we've been living here for about 5 years.
Well, that's great. And now let's go to the Middle Way Society. What led you to that, to form this organization with Robert Ellis?
Okay, well, I suppose another really formative thing that I've been involved in the last few years, I became a Samaritan about 5 years ago. I don't know if you have a similar...
I would love to hear about that, because I didn't know that there were Samaritans other than in Israel area. So I'd love to hear about that.
Well, the Samaritans are... it was set up in the 1950s, basically because there was a 14-year-old girl who committed suicide, and she just had nowhere to turn to. And this guy called Chad Vara felt that it was important that people who were, you know, who were feeling suicidal could have recourse to an organization that could provide emotional support.
Oh, I see. So it's not the religion, the Samaritans. It's an organization called the Samaritans.
That's right. Yeah. And what it does, it's a an organization that supports people in who are in distress and despair. So it's not just people who are suicidal, and it's probably mainly through telephone calls, but we also get face-to-face calls. We have a center, and people come if they're feeling troubled or vulnerable. They can come and talk to us, and we don't have any message, we don't have any answers. We're just what we do is try to listen, and you know, another human being trying to understand what's going on in another human being's life in a hopefully in an empathic way. And in the UK there are about 25,000 Samaritans altogether. We've got 200 centres around the country, and we actually get a lot of texts and emails, not just from the UK but from the United States, because I think quite a few states suicide is, if not illegal, is certainly frowned upon. And there's not as much it's quite difficult for them to have recourse to people who can, you know, provide emotional support. I don't know if that's changing now in the States or not.
We have suicide prevention hotlines.
Right.
And
okay.
People who I mean, I have a friend who works in a suicide prevention place as a counselor, but there's it's very professionalized, so the people who are answering the phones are trained therapists, and they go through this long training, and it's not really a center where people, it's kind of a crisis management, but not really offering day-to-day support. They might link people up with other organizations.
Okay.
Or therapy, but it sounds like the Samaritans are a, it sounds like more of a community that people can come to.
Sort of, yeah. We're all amateur. You know, we're not professionals at all. We do get training. Arguably, our strength is that we are not experts, and so people feel that they can engage with another human being without any sort of hierarchy or someone trying to analyze or make a big important part of the approach is that we're not non-judgmental. It's I suppose it's very similar to the sort of person-centered approach that you do get, you know, in sort of counseling, but so we don't give advice. We're completely non-advisory, although we do signpost occasionally. So if someone is has an issue with, they maybe have an alcohol problem. Now, if they if they express that they have a problem with alcohol, then we might signpost them. But if they, you know, if they don't express that it's a problem for them, then we wouldn't. No way would we would signpost in that situation. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yes. So you're there to be supportive and to respect people wherever they're at.
Yeah,
in the 60s.
Exactly. We also explore options with them. So we listen, but you know, it's like a active listening. So we reflect, we summarize. Yeah, so we do engage in a conversation. I'm actually interviewing someone in a couple of weeks who's a Samaritan, so she's going to talk about it in a lot more detail.
It sounds good. I'll look forward to hearing that.
Yeah.
This comes again to the Middle Way Society. How did so you were in this group, the Samaritans, and then
the Samaritans is, for me, it's a very grounding thing to do, and I go there once a week for about 3 hours, and it's like I tap into the human condition once a week, and it helps me to see things from a slightly wider perspective. And anyway, a few years ago, I was on shift one night, and I was just reading a book about depression, and there was a recommendation in the book about mindfulness. This book by Jon Kabat-Zinn called wherever you go, there you are, about meditation, basically. And actually, I'd actually been a bit skeptical about meditation because, again, through an experience I had in India, I spent about a month when I was in India on a yoga ashram. And I loved the yoga, but at the end of the yoga, they did the meditation, and I couldn't quite connect with it because it was all about separating yourself from your bodily experience and unifying yourself with like Atman. And I thought, this is not for me. And I thought that's what meditation was. And so, for 20 years, that was my understanding what meditation was. But then I started hearing about mindfulness about 7 or 8 years ago, and I saw this book in the Samaritans, and I was just about to go on holiday to Nepal on a trekking holiday, so I thought I'll buy this book and take it with me, and because I thought that would be a good place to have a look. So I thought I'd revisit meditation, and anyway, when I read it, it was the complete opposite of this idea that I'd had about meditation. It was about grounding yourself in your experience in a very embodied way. And I thought, ooh, this, I like this. And I remember on the book, on the holiday, was there was a group of us, and I read the book twice when I was there. And I thought, when I come back, I'll have to go on a retreat and try and do this properly. And I went on a couple of retreats shortly afterwards, and I eventually went on a retreat with the Stephen Batchelor and Martine Batchelor, and I resonated with a lot of his ideas, which I know you do too. And then I joined a blog called the Secular Buddhism UK, and I started interacting with Robert there. That's how I first met Robert online, with also two or three other people that are still in the Middleway Society now. Yeah, and then Robert organised a retreat for the Middleway Society, and I was very impressed with the approach, and I felt I resonated with a lot of the ideas. I felt very comfortable with it, and yeah, so I was happy to get involved. I like being at the start of things as well, that sort of excited me. And then about a month after we'd started, I said to Robert, maybe a good idea would be for us to get a podcast together. And then he said, well, why don't you do it? And my heart sank at first. I thought, I can't do anything like that. And then I thought, well, why not? I'll have a go. And but I thought, well, I've never done anything like this before, and I don't really know much about the Middle Way, but so far I've sort of survived, really.
You've done very well. I enjoy your podcast very much.
I can remember one of the earlier podcasts, someone asked me, what does the Middle Way mean to you? And I just froze, and I used an old teacher's trick and said, well, what does it mean to you? And
that's good. I've been enjoying your podcast very much. I'd like to know how it's been for you interviewing people and producing this podcast for the Middle Way Society.
It's been great, actually. I've learned so much through doing it, actually, Susan, because I'm not very good at actually sitting down and doing exams or things like that. For example, a couple of years ago, I tried to do a critical thinking course, and I paid money for it and everything, but I just couldn't keep it up. But with this, every week or every couple of weeks, I need to prepare for these interviews. So often I either read the book, or I get online, and what's very handy, people often do TED Talks and things like that. And I've learned so much through talking to people, so that it's been a great learning experience for me in that way. And it's helped me grow in confidence in talking to people as well. Sometimes I feel quite nervous at the beginning of I get a few butterflies just before I start talking to someone. But the vast majority, or I'd say all of them, all of the people I've interviewed have put me at my ease, really. Once you get talking, it's fine. So it's been a great experience.
That's great. Well, I'm really happy. Personally, I'm very happy that you do this, because I enjoy your podcast very much.
Oh, well, thank you.
So what do you do when you're not with the Samaritans or working with the Middle Way Society? Do you like to, are you involved in other organizations or sports or music or leisure activities?
I've recently become a member of the UK Green Party. I came across a website about a year ago. It was a really interesting site, actually. I don't know if you have similar things in the United States. It was called Policies Not Personalities. We have about five or six main parties in the UK. And what they did on this site, you chose certain policy areas like health, immigration, foreign policy, etc. And then they gave you the policies of the parties underneath, but they didn't tell you, you didn't know who the policies were. And I thought I was going to be about 40% Labour, maybe 20 or 30% Green, and then 30% another party. Because I would have had a soft spot for the Greens, but I always thought they were a bit wacky, a bit idealistic. Anyway, at the end, the result was that I ended up being 100% Green. So, and I thought I was voting for the most sort of pragmatic, sensible policies, but I don't know, it might make me a bit wacky, but I'm not so sure. I don't agree with everything they say, but I think they seem to be the only party that's really talking about the elephants in the room of climate change and unsustainable growth, really. And so, you know, I thought, well, I think it's important for me to get involved with that, and that's been really interesting. And I went round canvassing at the last election and knocking on doors and things like that. So, and I intend to, you know, to continue in my participation with them. I think those are the only two main organisations involved with.
So Barry, what was it about the Middle Way Society that attracted you?
Well, it was a sort of transition coming from the ideas from Stephen Batchelor, I think, really. I can remember, back to India again. I remember my first contact with Buddhism was, I came across this expression, if you meet the Buddha, kill him. And I just found that really interesting at the time, because and I immediately intuitively got the idea that it's about the message, not about the person. But I just really liked the fact that this little gem of irreverence could have survived 1,000 years in a religious tradition. And I thought, certainly with Christianity, it was funny, you know, and Christianity is devoid of any humor. And I'm not sure that's the case with to the same extent with Judaism. I think, I don't know, do you find humor in the Talmud?
Yes.
Well, there you go. I think that Christianity is totally devoid of, certainly in the biblical text anyway. So I thought that was really interesting, that, and I didn't think much of it since, but there was maybe a seed was sown there. And then after start going on these first couple of retreats, and principally I was interested in meditation, but then it automatically opened up a wider perspective that there was an ethical element inevitably involved with this exploration of mindfulness. And it got me thinking about where I stood in how I think about things like religion and things like that. Most of my life, probably, I would have called myself an atheist. But part of me always said, though, you know, ultimately, I don't know. I always like to quote Socrates saying, you know, at the Oracle, you know, that the only thing I know is I don't know. And I found that an expression in that, in the way Stephen Batchelor articulated his understanding of Buddhism. But I think what really drew me more so, in a sense, to the Middle Way is that the Middle Way Society is that the Middle Way can be seen as a principle that is universal, that can be used by anyone beyond any tradition, but within a tradition. This is what's really interesting about talking to you, Susan. You know, like you are a humanistic Jewish rabbi, but you don't see any conflict with that and the middle way, and I think that's really very exciting for me. It's something that can draw people together from all sorts of traditions and ways of thinking. To me it's very much a principle of judgment, a way of navigating through the world in an arguably more objective way. And I use objective in a not a God's eye view sense, but in a I think the middle way is a way of being more objective in the
seeing
sense
things from different people's point of view and not through an authority.
Yeah, but also navigating between extremes of dogmatic belief.
Mm-hmm.
I think that sort of tends to help you rely on re-experience more. And I think you can also be dogmatic about experience too. I think in order to take advantage of experience, that you need to approach it with reflection,
mm-hmm.
and
mindfulness
and with critical thought, mm-hmm. and an embodiment. But through that greater awareness, I think you can make arguably better decisions.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I find interesting. What I find interesting about Robert as well, that, you know, he doesn't put himself forward as any type of guru or anything. He sees himself as much a fallible human being as the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think he's put something together very interesting in the work he's done so far. And mm-hmm. the other thing I like about the society is its provisional nature, or middle way philosophy, is that it's something that we can all contribute to, that it's a work in progress. It's mm-hmm. not something that is fixed, and that it's mm-hmm. in a process of development. And I find that attractive too.
You know, it's interesting. I was thinking the other day about the name of the organization and thinking maybe it should be called the Middle Wayfarers. You know, because we're all on a journey together. The Middle Wayfarers.
I like that.
Society, which sounds kind of, you know, stodgy a little bit from an American point of view.
No, society. I actually really like that. Because the other one we've chosen is Miggleism, because it comes from a sort of childish use of miggle, so it plays on the idea that you don't take yourself too seriously as well. And a lot of people hate that as well. but I don't know, I've sort of got used to it, a bit like you get used to a word like Google or Yahoo.
Uh-huh.
But I do find middle way philosophy a mouthful.
Mm-hmm.
Or to call yourself a middle way practitioner.
Mm-hmm.
But a middle wayfarer, you know, I think that's...
We're on the journey of the middle way,
yeah.
Open with our open minds,
yeah,
and open hearts. It sounds good.
Yeah, no, I really like that, yeah.
Yeah. And this was a great interview, Barry. Thank you for talking with me today and being willing to sit in the other seat.
Thank you.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.